Welcome to your Kids Don't Suck. Kids don't suck anything that's sweet.
Parenting's hard, you don't know what to do. You're blaming your kids, but it's probably you. You love your kids and that you can trust. Just remember your kids don't suck.
Welcome to your Kids Don't Suck. Cultivating closeness with your children through non-coercive conscious parenting. We're your hosts, Kara Tedstone and Rathia Lee. Let's dive in and grow together.
I wanted to say about your child being the only kid that's crying in the park. So you have not been suppressing her feelings. So now she's not a kid who suppresses her feelings.
Yeah.
That is requires more of your attention and more of collaboration and awareness and empathy and like
more of my energy.
Yeah, it asks more of you. But it's a sign that you're doing it right, not the sign that you're doing it wrong.
I think you're so right. And then I have a part that says, my worry is that like people will judge her for being this big crybaby. Like, I'm like, are people looking at her parents also, kids, like older kids? And older kids, yeah, okay, they're older. She's only three, you know? But I guess, you know, as a parent of such a sensitive and emotional child, I like worry that she's going to be socially outcast for that. Like, that's a big fear I have. I'm so worried she's going to be bullied for being a big crybaby. And being sensitive and having, you know, not being able to handle whatever or just normal kid stuff that they do that like the other kids seem to not really react. Like if a kid takes a toy, I mean, yeah, they'll get upset, but they kind of get over it. Whereas my kid, she's hurt. Like her feelings are deeply hurt and yeah. She takes a long time to recover. And then something else could set her off. And, you know, she's like the type of kid where if she gets hurt slightly, like she'll be very upset. She's getting much, you know, she's getting better. I guess better, whatever, quote unquote. She's learning how to move through stuff. And I see that, but it's also, she definitely takes longer than the majority of her peers, which I find worrisome, not because I judge her feelings. I love her feelings and I think they're so important, but because I'm worried she's going to get like socially ostracized.
Right. So that sounds like about you.
Yes.
Because first of all, she hasn't learned to stuff it. So she lets it go through its whole cycle of expression. And also children use whatever hurt happens to let bigger feelings out that might be about nothing that has to do with the toy. It might be crying and really unconsciously crying about missing you when you're at work or about like feeling lonely at times or like seeing mean people or like seeing something on the videos that she never got to process. Like kids will take the opportunity to have their big feelings at those moments. And we don't really always know what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, oh, that's a little too much crying for just someone taking your toy away. But you don't know what your kid is processing.
I know. And I always try to remind myself of that because in these situations, there's like, I think my kid, there's a lot going on for my kid. She's taking in a lot. She's observing everybody. And she, I don't know, I think she's really attuned, you know, to like the experiences of other people. I think she's highly, you know, sensitive and highly aware. So her experience of the world, I think it's pretty intense.
Yes, she's highly empathetic.
Yeah. So like, I can relate. that's me.
Yeah.
And yet I just worry. I'm like, God, are people going to not like her? Because I guess, you know, that's kind of how I felt sometimes growing up, that people didn't really like that I was so passionate, so strong in my opinions and feelings. I was judged. I was shamed. I was like, yeah, I was isolated for that. I was bullied. And so I'm worried that she's going to be this like, I always talk to my husband about it. Like he's not really afraid in the same way. I am afraid for her to go to school and to integrate with all these kids of her same age. And like, I'm so terrified that she's going to be lonely because of the way she is.
Well, I guess I just want you know this, but I have and had a very highly sensitive, empathic child who's neurodivergent in different ways. And she was like that, like huge feelings, especially in public places.
Mm-hmm.
And now like she has a zillion friends. I mean, she's so, everyone tells her their problems. She attunes to people. She's really good at closeness. It's kind of her superpower, actually. She makes friends wherever she goes. She bonds so deeply.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's actually a good sign.
It is. And it's interesting because with little kids, all the parents, there's such a culture of wanting your kid to, you know, comply, settle down, right? Be quiet and like cooperative. But obviously, we all, it's so ironic wanting that from a young child and then also wanting that spirited, outgoing, right, emotionally available adult or young person.
Yeah.
So I like am holding on to that because I know that. But of course, you know, as we've discussed.
Well, that reminds me of the double, triple, quadruple standard for women who are supposed to be nurturing and receptive and loving and caring. We're supposed to be outgoing and getting things done. We're supposed to be managing everything. I mean, we can't win. We can't win. And so it sounds like you have some of that going on with her.
Definitely.
You want her to be sensitive and loving and caring and empathetic.
And also, I want her to be easygoing. It's like,
I know.
It's
you really
so
should
hard.
Give that up. I really think you need to give that up.
I know I need to give it up. And that's the thing. Like, that's what it was with me when I was younger, was like, why can't you just be easygoing? You're so hard. Like, you're so difficult, right? So I'm like, oh, fuck, man. It's all old stuff. Coming up.
It was really cool because at the end of our last podcast that I was listening to yesterday, which I was so into, I said something about how people tell me, parents tell me things are going really well with their kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I used to be really jealous of that. They'd be like, oh, no, things are easy. We're doing great. You know, the kids are great. They're just thriving, la, la, la. Then I would get around them and I'd hear how they talk to their kids and they're shaming and blaming and punishing. And they're telling me it's going great because they've gotten their kids to comply. And they call that great.
Yeah.
They call that successful and thriving because their kids can play the game.
Totally. I know. I totally agree. Just even being at the park and being around all the people, the parents and the caregivers talking to their kids, and I'm not talking to my kid like that, but yet I have this kid who's acting not like the other kids. And that is the sacrifice, at least in my situation, just because of the kid that I have. So that's what I'm always dealing with. And I, that's a big piece of this for me. It's very challenging for me and working on that constantly every single day.
Right, because it's hitting your belonging stuff. Mm-hmm. Now you don't belong because you have a kid who's acting different. So now you're weird. And so it's the same stuff as your kid stuff.
Yeah, it feels terrible.
Well, it's a really good segue into attachment issues, because this is related to your attachment issues. What are we talking about? I can't remember.
Well, the topic of the day is broadly speaking attachment, but then we had like a few other avenues we wanted to go down.
I'm kind of onto something new, and I don't know if you know a lot about it, because I don't. Do you know a lot about masking?
I don't know if I'm like an expert in masking, but I know a lot about it.
I mean, I think it's related to attachment,
mm-hmm.
but I'm starting to think I might be unmasking in my primary relationship right now.
Primary meaning?
My partnership with Will. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, I think that might be what's happening to me.
Interesting.
Yeah, because I hit this sudden place where all of a sudden, like, I couldn't manage certain things in our relationship, and I went into a lot of terror of him.
Mm.
And I didn't know why. And now I'm starting to realize, I mean, it's memory.
Mm-hmm.
It's a memory of living with a man who was, it seemed to me as a child, was trying to kill me and also keep me alive to torture me. Okay, so like, that was... you know, that's what I grew up with. And I've had this loving relationship for 10 years. And all of a sudden, I'm feeling abject terror towards Will. I feel like he's going to kill me.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously memory.
So that's what it was. That was the feeling underneath all of the other stuff. Like, he's going to kill me. I'm terrified.
Yeah. And I've been caretaking him. I'm waking up, as menopausal women do, to the fact that I've been caretaking him for all these years, making sure he's okay all the time. Mm-hmm. He's okay. And I'll hold everything down. You know, whatever he needs. I mean, he's amazing. It's not his fault. This is my stuff. Whatever he needs, he can do. And I will just hold the fort down of the home and the parenting and everything and all the details. I will hold that down, and he can, you know, go in and out of whatever he needs. And now all of a sudden I can't do that. And I'm filled with unbelievable amounts of rage and also terror. And I'm starting to think, oh, I think maybe I'm unmasking in the relationship. I don't want to be the caretaker like that anymore. I can't. Mm-hmm. I don't want to, and I can't. And what happens when women lose estrogen is like, it's like a hormone that keeps you being able to bounce back and be really fluid. And it allows you to be very generous. And I don't have estrogen. So I feel like it's forcing me to unmask.
That's so interesting.
And putting it in that context is helping me so much to have empathy for myself, because I'm like, what the fuck? Why am I suddenly terrified of my 10-year relationship boyfriend? Like, that's weird. But, you know, and to kind of demoralizing, like, why am I going into memory at this level? But now I think I'm starting to understand. I don't know how that relates to attachment, but obviously it does, because I was attached to my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a dangerous, dangerous person. So what is it like to bond to a very dangerous person that I developed my entire brain and body around that? That's
right.
Inconceivable.
Right. You created your entire persona around that as a foundation. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've been thinking about my whole personality, like my entire personality that I built.
Yeah. All the parts.
Which hopefully our children are not building, right? We're hoping our children are not building these people-pleasing, caretaking, fawning selves. That's what we're hoping for.
Yeah.
And yet it's hard when they don't, because it's scary. It's like, no, you need to people-please and caretake and fawn, or no one's going to like you.
Yeah.
Because that's what we had to do to get love.
Yeah.
And to create relationships.
Maybe we should provide a definition of attachment then.
What do you think attachment is, Kara? What would be your definition?
I'll read the definition that this is on Google. Attachment refers to a deep and enduring emotional bond that connects one person to another across time and space.
Can you say that again?
Attachment refers to a deep and enduring emotional bond that connects one person to another across time and space.
Uh-huh.
That feels good.
I guess so. That's pretty light. I mean, we're talking about biological attachment, like a genetic.
That's
like
very broad.
Like DNA, like, you know, your brain develops around your parent or your caregiver for survival, by the way. Like attachment is survival. It's not just like a deep bond. It's like actually survival. And what I understand about attachment is we attach to whatever's there.
Mm-hmm.
We search for the love, but we also attach to violence. We also attach to neglect. We also attach to judgment. We attach to whatever we can attach to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what's interesting about that is it's speaking to like generally, like anything. And that's so true. Like folks who are like adoption, like people who are adopted, mm-hmm. you know, people who are abandoned, you know, given to the system so that they can be with another caregiver. Like a lot of folks will be adopted young and say like, I have no, you know, like I have such loving parents, you know, and I'm so grateful for my adoptive parents, but there's still attachment trauma there. Right. Even if you're adopted into, like, even if you know what I'm saying? Like, so genetically speaking, like how you said, who we come from, like where we, like where, who our origin is.
Well, it's biological.
Mm-hmm.
It starts in the womb.
Mm-hmm. And it's designed to.
Yes, it's designed to.
So even regardless of who raises us and who's there and, you know, all of that, like that also affects us.
Yeah.
Deeply and profoundly and eternally.
Yeah. And I feel like I have many reasons why I feel like I'm not, there's reasons why I've not completely lost my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is that when I was very, very young, which I have a memory of, I never forgot, I made a decision that I was going to stop attaching to my parents and start attaching to people outside the home. I made an actual conscious choice. And I started just like pouring all my energy and time into my friends that I had. And that became my main strategy throughout my entire life. And it still is.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up creating a family of choice that I raised my daughter with, you know, people who are really healthy, and Tori's grown up with them as her cousins. And that strategy I chose when I was 5 is the thing that kept me sane. And, you know, I attached to people who were not my parents.
Mm. That's beautiful and so sad.
It is so sad.
Yeah.
And I've been crying lately about different things, and I've been crying about losing my family even after all these years. I can't believe I still sob and cry about it. Like that's how much attachment is, how powerful it is. It's 30. I haven't seen them in 32 years and I'm still sobbing my guts out about missing my parents. Like it's crazy.
Yeah. Despite what they've done to you.
Yeah. Because I loved them. I love, you know, we love our parents. No matter what.
Mm-hmm.
I do wonder, like when I'm really triggered, I do wonder, can I heal? Can I heal my attachment trauma? I wonder. Sometimes I think I can't.
Well, what do you think about that? Do you think people can heal?
I mean, healing is a process. It's not an event, you know? I mean, I am obviously healing, but I guess I just, the level of pain that I have to live with, I still don't know. The jury's out.
On whether that sort of decreases or?
I don't even know. What is healing?
Right.
I still don't feel like, okay, this is what it is. I still don't feel like I really love myself.
You don't feel?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No, I feel like I'm extremely loving to other people and I don't feel very loving to myself. And I feel like that's attachment trauma.
Yeah.
That makes me want to cry. Like I try so hard to love myself. I have a million tools. I have so many things I do to try to be kind to myself and it's almost impossible. It's almost fucking impossible.
And I guess I wonder, because I don't either. I wonder if, I guess there are people out there that really do. There must be, right? There are people out there that really do love themselves like deeply.
I have no idea.
I wonder. I don't know.
I mean, I think, I don't know because I have no idea. I mean, I definitely witness in my clients periods of time where these awakening of absolute growth and
in yourself.
And I have it in myself too. I just went on a retreat and danced for 4 days and I felt ecstasy. I really did. Like, so I have that. Most people don't have that. I was in my body and I felt sensual and I felt passionate. I was amazing. So I have that. So I have that. It's just not.
It's not all the time.
It's not lasting, but you know, also because there's things, because I have post-traumatic stress, the world is triggering me all the time. My daughter's triggering me all the time. My partner's triggering me all the time. Aging triggers me. I mean, you know, there's all these triggers and that's where I wish I was more healed. I wish that didn't send me into self-attack.
Right. Right. That you were more balanced or something.
Yeah, that I could love myself.
Yeah.
Like I could love myself no matter what's
happening. You could stay grounded in that.
Yeah, I really want that. Right. I really want that. Oh, I want that so much. I pray for it. I do all these things to practice just, you know, I've had some great moments. Like recently, I thought my daughter was getting into something scary. It turns out that she wasn't, but I thought she was. And my first impulse was like, okay, it's not your fault. I just came right to myself and said, sweetheart, it's not your fault. Doesn't mean you did anything wrong. This is completely normal. Like I said, all these really loving things to myself. And I managed to not spiral into,
that's so
I'm
cool.
A fucking failure. I, you know, like attack myself. And then when you attack yourself, then you have to do a whole process of coming out of the attack, which like takes so much energy to come out of self-hatred. That takes up so much of my spoons.
Yeah. And I guess I'm just thinking about people who maybe aren't aware of that underlying piece, right? Because you're talking about like self-hatred. A lot of people aren't necessarily thinking about that, aren't necessarily tuned in to the fact that actually deep down they too feel that way.
Yeah.
At times, right?
Yeah.
So instead they'll go for blame and shame of the people around them. In the context of relationships, I guess, thinking about parents and kids, you know, the way that you sort of were able to hold on to yourself instead of get upset with her and go, you're so irresponsible, you know, I can't trust you.
Well, also like time to bring in the control, time to bring in coercion and accuse her of things.
Accuse her, make her the reason this is happening.
Yeah.
You actually went instead to, I need to check in with myself so I can get to a place where I'm grounded in feeling like this isn't my fault. Because if I am unconsciously thinking this is my fault, I'm going to, there's something about feeling like you're powerless, you know, that this is your fault, that you're, you know, this is like a whole big out of control situation, you know, like it very can quickly spiral into this huge fear. And then ultimately like self-hatred is tied into that.
That is such a good point, because I do think we control out of self-blame.
Yeah.
And we put the blame on them, right?
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
It's the blame game. Yeah. It's like, you're making me feel, child, you're making me feel really out of control, and you're making me not love myself and blame myself. So I need to change you.
And making me feel like it's my fault that we got here. Yet, you know, that's actually not typically the truth with our kids. It's actually not typically the truth when they go and make decisions, because they're autonomous individuals.
Well, and even if it is our quote unquote fault, like even if we're part of the dynamic, which we are, we don't have to blame and attack ourselves and shame ourselves, because we do hurt our children. We do. We absolutely do. No matter how hard we try, we harm our children. You know, now that my daughter's 13, she tells me, you know, Mom, you're so reactive. You're so needy. You pull on me. You're always catastrophizing. All of that is true. Mm-hmm. And it's not my fucking fault.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my fucking fault. Like, I've worked so, so hard. I still have all the trauma that I have.
Yeah.
And she's getting it. She's getting it. I mean, I do my best to mitigate it. I work so hard, but like, I am also have anxiety, and she's growing up around someone who was horrifically abused, and that's going to affect her. And there's nothing I can do about that.
Yeah.
That part of it. And that's true for most parents. We have trauma. Our kids are going to get, they're going to get it. They're going to pick up on it. You're modeling it. You're doing your coping strategies. They see you doing it. I mean, we're wounded. They're seeing us be wounded. There's no way around that.
Yeah. And I always feel very sad when I hear that, but there's also an equal amount of relief because there's something about, I can let go of the self-blame if I'm continually reminding myself of that, that it's happening regardless. The best I can do is to be conscious of that.
Yeah.
The very best I can do is to be continuously conscious of what is happening and really examining and reflecting and being in communication and connection with what is happening so that I don't blame myself and I don't blame my kid. And not stepping outside and going, no, this isn't real. You know, what you're experiencing is not true.
Yeah, like, no, it's no. What are you talking about? It's you. You know, we were at a family meeting. We have these weekly family meetings. It's me, my partner, Tori's dad, and Tori. We talk about how everything's going. And she gave a report on each parent, how she feels about each parent in the meeting. But to me, we're really working on me not saying anything about her eating or food because I have so much stress and anxiety around food. Now we've made an agreement. I'm just going to stop saying anything about it. And so in the meeting, she goes, well, because generally I'm very annoying to her, but she's working on it. But anyway, she said in the meeting, Mom, you're doing really well. You're still doing bad with food, but you're doing really well. Mm-hmm. I felt so happy. Mm. I was like, okay, I'm doing really well. Still just got to work on the food thing, you know? And like, it's just so wonderful that she could give me the feedback and she could see me as a work in progress.
That's what I was just thinking.
That's fucking amazing. The mom's working on it.
Yeah. It's amazing that she can like actually rest into that my parent is actually accountable, working on something that I care about, that I need from them. I mean, it's really amazing that, you know, you have a child who day to day can look at you and go, if I have something to tell you, I can trust. Like really know and trust that you're going to hear me. I know I've said that so many times, but I think that's like so profound. Typically it's the child brings something to the parent. The parent goes, yeah, but you.
Or no, I am not. No, I don't
right.
do that.
What I mean, denial, of course. Too.
Or like, don't talk to me that way. Like, that's not okay. I'm the one with the power, you know, go to your room or like you're punished or like, that's not acceptable. That's not okay. You can't say things like that to me. Amazing that you and I can just like get into stuff so quickly. It's so cool.
I know. Yeah. I was just thinking very quickly before we move on about how in my work with parents and kids, I often work with the duo, like the one parent and the one child who are having like issues. And I really try to get the parent to just listen. Like that's one of the things that I really try to get them to hear. So I'll keep helping the kid summarize and I'll keep pulling out what is really happening for the kids so that the parent can really hear. Because most parents will start off with, okay, this is the dynamic between me and my kid. And parents who are looking for family therapy too, they're already kind of the doors open, right? They're reflective in a way because they're like, something's happening and I know that I'm in the dynamic too. These are the clients that I get at least. I think that's what happens when, you know, you reach out to a family therapist, like you're looking for support, you know, for the relationship. So the door's already open for reflexivity. But what I help them really learn is that they already have all these biases that they are like sort of blocking them from really actually showing up in an attuned way to the child. So I have to help them just hear what the kid is really asking of them and really saying and really feeling and needing. Because I know I'll do that with my own daughter. Like she'll have done something that I'm frustrated about and I'll want to go, yeah, but if you hadn't done that, you know, if you didn't freak out when I mentioned this thing, then we wouldn't have to be in this conflict. Like you could just chill, right? And the parents will say that, like if my kid just would, you know, get quicker, ready faster for school, or take accountability for their appointments. If they would just, you know, you have to look at your role that you play. And I understand that in the context of like a partnership with like couples, like that's a very different lens.
Yes.
But in the family hierarchy, like where the child's always the child in the relationship, we don't use that lens. So it's so important for people to unlearn a lot of that. I think we're really conditioned to go like our children are responsible for showing up for us in whatever way we expect and demand.
Well, right. And this is like the thing we talk about in all of our episodes is about the power structure. I mean, I cannot believe parents don't really even know there's a power structure. Most parents.
I have to explain it. I'm like, so in a family system, there is a hierarchy. And a power structure, and our children are at the bottom. And so a lot of the struggles that we see are actually the result of the hierarchy and the child feeling unseen and unheard and undervalued, underappreciated, misunderstood. And so when we can level the playing field, and this is where the non-coercion comes in. I was just talking to Vivek the other day, and he was saying he'd like to have me on his group, you know, that he does. So he was like, I'm going to introduce you as someone who sneakily kind of in your own way introduces families to non-coercive collaborative parenting. And that's what I do. I help them understand that in this dynamic, everybody feels heard. We're going from a domination culture and a control culture to a partnership culture. That's Bell Hooks's way of framing it. But I use that language because it's helpful to see like, oh, it's a hierarchy. Okay, now we're going to flip it. We're going to do something different. It's going to result in a lot of really good stuff, but we're going to have to unlearn a lot of the programming and go for partnership now.
Why, I really like that.
Yeah, it's great.
Which of her books, or is it just all of her books?
Well, I believe she references this in other work, but this is specifically from The Will to Change, and it's on men, masculinity, and love.
Oh.
So in the context of patriarchy, that's what she's talking about. Domination culture is patriarchy, capitalism, imperialism.
God, she was
white supremacy.
Amazing.
I know.
I was coaching a parent the other day, and she said the thing that so many people say she has a teenager and she doesn't want him to listen to loud music. She said something like, this is my house.
I'm sorry. I have to have a chuckle at that. She doesn't want her teenager to listen.
No, she doesn't like his music. She doesn't like his music. And he should just wear headphones, you know, which is fine. She can ask him to wear headphones, but whatever. But the point is, she said, it's my house. But
that's what teenagers do.
Well, I understand. But she said, this is my house. Teenager. This is my house. I pay for this house. I pay for everything in this house. If I tell him not to play his music loud, he should listen. And I was like, it's not his fault. He was born into this house and it's his house. It's his house. Like, that's so unfair. Like, how can you say it's your house?
Like, he lives there too.
How do you think your kid's going to feel knowing that you don't think of it as their house? And that's just like a basic, basic thing. That's just like, I know. 101, you were born in a house. You were born in an apartment.
My friend was just saying this. It's so funny. She was just telling me on a voice note. She was like, you know, the whole idea of patriotism, how do you say that? I don't know. Being patriotic.
Patriotism.
Okay. The whole idea is just ridiculous. She was like, you do realize that like we're all just born in a place, and to be proud of where you're born, where you happen to be a cell born onto the earth in a place in a random location is ridiculous. And she was just like going on and on. And that just made me think of that because it's so true. Children do not ask to be born.
No.
And we have them. And then to say that, you know, we obviously, like, if we can't acknowledge that we hold all the resources and they didn't ask for that. They didn't ask for this hierarchy that they're born into.
No, and it's their resources too. I think of my money as my daughter's money. Like, it's not her fault that she can't make money yet.
Exactly.
Jeez.
Totally. And my food is her food. And, you know.
Right. My stuff is her stuff.
Totally.
And, yeah. But, you know, parents also get into, I have needs, you know, that's the whole thing. I have needs. What about my needs? So why should I listen? I'm, you know, she's neurodivergent. Why should I listen? This music really, really rattles my
ears. Right, it hurts my ears. And I also get that. I just want to say, like, as snarky as I'm being, to laugh and say like, oh, you know, this is what teenagers do. I get it. Like, if it's pounding in your house and, you know, it's driving you insane, like, I too would be irritated. I totally understand that. But I just wanted to, I think the reframe is, okay, but how do we work together?
Yeah, and you can still negotiate and collaborate on sound and all of that, but you don't have to do it with the power over lens, because that energetic is going to just create so much separation. And also, she's like proclaiming really loudly how much she hates his kind of music. I'm like, what a lost opportunity.
That's a really disconnecting concept.
Yeah, I said to her, you really should learn what's good about his music. Like,
right,
you should
find something. Yeah,
I suggest if you want to be close to him, you get off your stance that the music is terrible. I mean,
yes,
my kid is getting into horror movies, which is literally like the biggest trigger I can even ever tell you. I was actually shown horror movies as a kid by my father.
I'm so sorry.
And she wants to tell me about it. And I can't help, my whole body starts going, instead of just saying I hate horror movies, I'm like, okay, you can tell me absolutely everything, but just don't explain the knives and the blood. I said, Will can hear all about the knives and the blood. I can't hear about the knives and the blood, but tell me about all the plot. And she did. She's really into it. She's telling me all the characters and the plot twists and what she likes about it and the suspense and how it looks fake. And, you know, if I just said I hate horror movies, don't talk about it with me, then that would, my God, like...
Mm-hmm. Such a big part of their world.
What if this
right?
is her passion? What if exactly. she becomes someone who makes horror movies? I mean, you know what I mean?
And also, like, you know, even though our kids go through phases and stuff like that, like, even with my daughter right now, she's really into this really what the culture would presume is brain rot, right? Like this show that comes on whatever, Amazon Prime, and it's on YouTube too, and it's called Little World, and it's just babies doing stuff, really animated babies going around and doing things, and they sing nursery songs, and that's, it's just over and over, like an
Are
hour
they
of that.
Cartoons
animated, okay. Yeah, like kind of like, yeah, big eyes, like really over exaggerated. My kid loves that, and she's three, so she's still a little kid, but she's also getting older. There's something about it that she loves. She's also really into being a baby right now, and so there's just something about it. I'm trying to frame it that way because I think it's the worst show ever made. It's so boring. It's so annoying.
I really understand.
Right?
Honey.
It's just,
I really,
like,
do.
I hate it. And she watches it a lot. She loves it. And she's like, I want to watch Little World. And I just try to go, okay, sweetheart, like, let's do it. I'll watch with you. Like, I'm trying to go, there's something about this that's comforting for her.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah,
like, good for her. That's healthy for her. That she, right, she's getting some need met. Versus, yes, going, which I could do if I wasn't kind of on this path, I'd go, we're not watching that because it's not good for your brain and it's overstimulating and it's not educational and you're too old for that. You can watch educational shows like Magic School Bus or whatever.
Right.
But I don't, you know, I try to really join with her. Like, that's really important to me because it's a part of her world. She's got, like, so much of her life is wrapped up in our decision-making as parents and where she can have autonomy in her interests. I really want to join there. I want to let her know that, like, that's a value of mine too. What she's into, I love that for her.
Right. And just for our listeners, in case you're new here, it might just seem like, well, why can't you just tell a three-year-old we're not watching that? But that, over time, will become a suppression of her impulses and instincts and desires, when then she's going to eventually have to sneak to get around Kara to do what she wants to do. And then Kara won't be a part of it. So it just creates two separate worlds.
I also, like, there's something about saying yes there that is even more about a connection in that moment. Like, I want her to know that I am not shaming what she's, like, I don't want to yuck her yum, you know? I don't want to be like,
yeah,
oh, like, that's a stupid show. It's bad. It's...
She will judge herself. She will judge herself,
yeah,
for liking it. She will. She'll be like, what's wrong with me for liking it? My mom says it's a bad thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I know it's really tricky and we won't go down this rabbit hole, but I know it's hard when parents have questions about what their kids are watching and the content and, you know, but I just want to really reiterate again that there are ways to talk about this in loving ways, like connected, non-shaming ways that you can solve these problems together and have a real conversation where you're actually heard too, that your kid is, like, getting your perspective.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Well, Tori does this thing with the horror movies where she goes, mom, don't watch because of your trauma. So she says to me, she's so sweet. She goes, mom, don't come here because it's playing and it'll get your trauma. It'll hit your trauma.
Oh,
or she'll say
I
to her
that.
Friends, my mom can't watch horror movies because of her trauma.
Oh, that's
just
really
go, mom,
sweet.
This is going to remind you of your childhood. So she, like, totally gets it.
She
totally gets why I can't hear about the certain things.
I mean, I love that the way that also you share with her. I know you do it developmentally appropriately. It's not like you're going into it and burdening her with all your past, but you tell her what's really going on in a way that makes sense to her and is digestible. And you don't do the other thing where it's like, no, you just we're setting a limit here. I just think that's stupid, or I just think that's wrong, you know? And so then you can have this reciprocated awareness. You get that deep empathy on her end. She gets really why you feel this way. You know what I mean? Like
Yes.
like if you just didn't like rap music because you thought it was grating, but your kid was obsessed with rap music and you didn't let them listen, they'd be like, my mom's such a loser. My mom's a nerd. You know, my mom doesn't get it what the cool kids are doing. My mom's like out of like touch. And I just think that's such a shame, a missed opportunity.
If I said you can't watch horror movies, that's not allowed, which I'm sure lots and lots of parents do. I'd be like,
Yeah.
honey, I know your friends are watching it, but like, that's not okay with me. Like, no, she would sneak it. I'm positive. And
Yeah.
then if she snuck it, then I can't be part of whatever comes up for her about it. I mean, this is the same theory about everything, trying drugs and sex and all this stuff. It's like, if you forbid it, you will then not be part of the learning. You go from being complete, you go to being on the inside to being on the outside. This is why we do this entire podcast. That's the reason why we do the whole podcast. But Kara, I want to transition to talking about your attachment issues because we talked about mine a little bit. I want to talk about yours.
Well, at the beginning, we were talking about isolation with my daughter, me feeling I was talking to you about my fears around her big feelings because she is so emotional, much more so than the majority of her peers, and cries for long periods of time, cries often, and you know, she's very sensitive and you know, she's emotional. So, I think that that's a huge trigger for me because I was shamed by lots of people. Also my primary attachment, you know, figures, which is sad for my parents to hear because they listen to the show. So it's like, it's a hard one, but ultimately true that I think back then it was really not okay to be loud about feelings. Like I had to be subdued. And so I was told that I was like overreacting and too much and like ridiculous and just what was the phrase was the always was I was told I think overreacting was a big one. Like I just remember that word being very like I felt like that must be true. I must be, you know, totally.
That really reminds me of, the crux of sexism too.
Yes, yeah.
Like a hysterical
Exactly,
girl.
hysterical, totally, exactly. So that was like painful, like really painful, like extremely traumatic for me, even though it sounds really maybe a little bit silly, especially in comparison to your stuff.
I
But
know, just don't,
honestly,
you don't have to compare. I mean, not being able to be yourself is traumatic for children.
that's what I want to get at is like as worse, much more worse things could have happened to me, that actually was traumatic for me. And so that had led me to mask so much of myself
I
for
was
so
just going to
long.
ask you, or do you relate to the word masking?
Absolutely, yeah. I had to like turn off that part of myself in certain ways. I remember like my best friend, who's still my best friend, she had her first kiss when we were in like grade 7 or whatever. I hadn't had my first kiss yet. And she didn't tell me first, she told another person first, and I fucking freaked out. I like lost my mind. I felt such like a loser. Like she chose someone else over me. We're supposed to be best friends. She's still my best friend today.
Oh
So
my
this is,
God,
yeah.
that's
Yeah, we're
amazing.
like sisters.
What's her name?
My best friend, Ileana.
Ileana, how could you have told someone else before you told Kara? That is so wrong. We're still really upset about that.
I'm still triggered. I still talk about this
How
every
dare
week in
you?
therapy.
That was a real betrayal.
Right, such a betrayal. So, you know, I'm 12 and this was like the biggest, worst thing that's ever happened to me. So I remember freaking out and there was a sleepover with a few of them and the girl she told was there. And anyway, I just remember like crying in the bathroom. I like had a lot of feelings, but I like locked myself in there and it was just this big dramatic thing. And I remember she was actually really like kind about it. She was like, I'm sorry, I really didn't realize that like you would be so upset. Like, I get it. Like I don't remember her shaming me. So I came out of it and it was okay, but I just remember at the time the one The worst part was not that like she had done that, but it was I could not control my reaction and I was shaming the shit out of myself. What's wrong with you? I was telling myself, you're such a fucking loser. You know, why are you freaking out about this? This is so insane. You know, nobody else would ever care. Like, you are just too much. And then, you know, having that reaction that I did, I think I was judged by a couple other people that were at that sleepover because it was a lot what I was doing. I was like really upset and causing a scene. It was really just, yeah, a sort of profound, like this memory for me is a profound reminder of how it feels to be isolated because you are deemed as too much.
Yeah.
And you're not on the level and you're not able to like handle things and you make a big deal. Like I was always the kid that would, you know, call home and tell my mom about something dangerous happening. I like did that a few times. I would call my mom and be like, pick me up. They're doing something that I don't want to do. And I know the people there were like, loser, like weirdo, you know, she's overreacting. Totally. It's fine. But it was shit that I thought actually was genuinely very unsafe and I was not okay with it, but I know that I was judged for that. And I think my daughter, I see that in my daughter, like she's really cautious and like she's not gonna be a risk taker, I don't think. I mean, maybe, but she's not a risk taker.
I don't know
right
I didn't
now.
Think my daughter was gonna be a risk taker either,
and then she became one. Yeah, that's true.
Well,
you don't know
what happens is when children get a really secure attachment,
right, they feel safe,
they can fly at some point, they can just really go for shit. But that's what I've seen in my daughter. Like we were like one person for, and then now she's just like off and running.
Right.
I mean, it's
right.
just amazing. Actually,
that is amazing.
I'm not saying she's a risk taker in a. I'm not saying she's a risk taker in a dangerous way.
Right, but she is not afraid to try things.
Well, she was afraid. That's what's so weird. She was never a kid who ran into the street or like ran over. She never climbed scary things. Like she never
my
did any of that. She stayed really close to me. Now she's like a roller coaster person, like she goes on the upside down, all the I can't even do any of that, so she goes up things that drop. I mean, she's watching horror movies, like she's into the thrill. I never thought that's not how she seemed, that's not how she presented
right
at all. She was like meh, and she didn't want to go anywhere or do anything. That's how she was for so long, so you just never know where this is gonna shake out.
So true. But yeah, I guess I brought all that up because you asked about my own attachment stuff, and that's how that comes up for my kid a lot. I think that's a big part of it. I mean, I have other fears, but they're not as pervasive as this one of my kid being an outcast socially. Like I'm terrified she's going to be this like big loser. No one's going to like her and she's going to be like too sensitive for everybody and people are going to like hate that about her. And I'm working so hard to preserve that. Like I don't want to shame her for her feelings.
Right.
But at the same time, I'm like, shouldn't I be? Because, like, isn't that how you get them to stop acting like that? And then they're likable. But of course, that's not what I'm doing in practice. But that thought does occur to me, right? So it is just a very big mind fuck. And I'm working on it constantly. I'm just.
Yeah. So this is what coercive parenting gave you.
Yeah.
This is what conditional love did to you.
Yeah. And I don't want to think of my child as a project. Like I was walking home from the park this morning, having had that experience. And I went, Kara, like she's her own person.
Yeah.
Like let her be who she is. Like this is the way she is. Embrace it. Stop trying to get her to stop being that way and dreading these, you know, experiences. Just like lean into it, you know?
Well, this is the self-love piece that I was talking about with myself. Is you would want to take the focus to your inner child and say, honey, she's safe. She's not going to be outcasted. You know why? Because she has me and I'll always be there for her and we'll figure it out together. She's not you. That's not you over there. You know, like bring the love to yourself in those moments that your daughter is not you. She's not you.
She's not me. I know.
No, she's not having your experience at all.
Right. So true. I hope not. I guess another part of me really worries that I am shaming her regularly, you know, like by accident or with my the way that I'm triggered. Cause I know that when we're triggered, actually that gets transmitted, you know, in our body language.
Yeah. That she's picking up on your judgment,
my disapproval
feelings, even though you're trying really hard not to.
Exactly. And I really, really wish that I could embrace completely and completely just be like, that's Aaliyah. She's perfect the way she is. Like, that's great about her. But of course I'm not there. And so it comes across, I'm sure. I know she feels it. Even if I don't say it, I shut down a little bit. Maybe I'm not all there for her, even though I'm there physically. And I'm like, come, I'll hug you. Like, I'm right here. I tell her I'm here. I got you. I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah.
And yet I know inside I'm a little tight.
So I have a suggestion about that.
Yeah.
I'm really into this. I don't know if I've said it on our podcast yet. I might have. Tell me if I have. I'm really into the psychic, like hanging out with our kids on the psychic plane.
Yeah. This is like a meditation thing you do?
Yeah, when I feel separate from my daughter and she's pushing me away really hard, which she's supposed to do, and she's individuating and I feel so helpless and powerless. I do these meditations where I enter sacred space with her and I usually ask her, I would love to connect with you. What would feel good to you? And sometimes she wants me to hold her. Sometimes she just wants me to touch her feet. Sometimes I rub her back. Sometimes I bring in lots of other like people in our lives who love her and I have us all like give her energy together in my mind. But I tell her things on the psychic plane about what I appreciate about her, what I love about her, what I'm sorry about. And I try to tell her like, you know, this was about me. This is not about you. Like things, because Aaliyah can't understand it. Like a lot of those things at this age, but you can psychically say all those things to her.
Right.
You could say, I'm taking back any of the judgments. Like in meditation, you could say, I'm taking back any of the judgments I've put on you. Mm. I take it all back. I take all that energy back. That was not about you. That was about me and my little girl. And I'm taking it all back.
Mm.
And just like have some kind of image of how you take it all the judgment back.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a kind of repair.
Yeah, I could feel that being really, really shifting my energy, you know, like really actually effective for me to move from one place to another.
It's helped me so much.
Yeah.
With my kid. And also sometimes the next day or a couple of days later, we actually have the interaction that I had in my meditation. That's happened many times.
Mm.
Like in my meditation, I'll be rubbing her back. And then a couple of days later, I'll be rubbing her back like the exact same way I imagined it in my meditation. And she'll fully take it in. I'll be like, wow, this was real.
Right. Because something inside you has shifted.
Yes.
Right. That's what it is. Like if there's an opening on our end, I mean, I always have said that since she was a baby, I always knew it was like my energy is affecting her.
Honey, there's no way around that.
I know.
That's attachment. That's attachment. I wanted to ask you, do you have a label for your attachment style? Like, do you go, oh, I'm an anxious attacher. I'm a avoidant attacher. I'm ambivalent. Those are the ones.
That's a good question. I've never thought about it.
You haven't?
No. What about you?
Okay, wait. So there's anxious, ambivalent, and avoidant. I swear to God, I have all of those. I don't fucking... I have all of those.
Well, that's why I don't use those labels, because I think about it more as patterns. Like, when this happens, I show up like this. When this happens, I show up like this.
I was an anxious attacher in all my relationships before the one I'm in. So I would pick unavailable people, emotionally unavailable, and then I would try to get them to love me and fail over and over again and relive my childhood. Okay, so then I finally evolved and grew to picking someone who's really, really emotionally available. Now I've been in avoidant attachment. Mm-hmm. Now he's coming towards me with love and wanting a connection, and I'm like, get the F away from me. I'm going to all my avoidant attachment patterns, which I don't believe are permanent. They are healable.
Yeah.
They're healable.
Yeah, and people bring out certain behaviors in us too and certain experiences. So I think like to say I have this one style with everybody, it's like not really accurate, I don't think. I think it's much more complicated and nuanced than that, especially when we're dealing with trauma, you know, real serious, significant trauma, like complex trauma.
Right.
That's not how it is. It's not just like, oh, this happened to me. And so therefore here's the formula and this is how I behave. It's like, no, there are nuances to that. And so that's why I don't really like think I, but I think anxiously attached would be how I also tend to operate, is emotionally unavailable people. I try to get them to be available.
Right. Which probably means you are like hiding all your avoidant stuff, because that's what I realized, that I was purposely making sure I didn't feel my avoidance. So because avoidant attachment feels to me like it's about violation.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the worst. That's so hard to heal and be with and feel, is violation. It's just, I'd rather feel abandoned all day long than feel violated. So that's why I unconsciously, this is all unconscious. By the way, what's ambivalent? What's ambivalent attachment?
I mean, I think this is how it's described on, again, Google, but it says it's a style of insecure attachment where individuals crave closeness, but also fear abandonment and struggle with trust, which can lead to a pattern of seeking reassurance and validation while simultaneously pushing away those who try to offer it, resulting in emotional instability and anxiety.
Oh, well, that's me.
Yeah. So this is the thing.
That's me. That's push and pull.
Push and pull. Exactly.
Come here. I need you. Don't go away. Get the fuck away from me. Don't touch me.
Yeah.
That's me. Oh my God. It's so fun. I hope you can join me in ambivalent attachment. It's the worst fucking ever. It's like, you know why it's so bad? Because it's like, mom, dad, I need you. I'm going to die without you. Oh my God. You're totally unsafe. Get the fuck away from me. I mean, could you think of anything more of a mind fuck than having parents that are unsafe and don't meet your needs? Like, anyway, it's healable.
I think it's more helpful to be, instead of trying to put ourselves into like categories, you know, of like what the attachment styles are.
I'm going to have to argue with that.
You think it's helpful?
I think that naming these kinds of things is incredibly helpful.
Do you think so? I haven't found it helpful for me.
Well, it's usually helpful for a certain phase of your healing process.
Mm.
The word avoidant is like, oh my God, it's helped me so much to see my avoidant parts.
But that's what it is. I think like attachment styles tend to, I think people can experience them in a way that not that it's, it, that's not the intended use of the language, but they'll sort of like have a hard time unblending or seeing that that's a part.
Right. You know it just becomes like, this is what I do and this is who I am.
And this is how I am. And so I need a partner that isn't going to trigger this in me rather than sort of doing that parts work that I think is much more helpful, especially for like CPTSD and, you know, trauma, which is more about like the reflective sort of like parsing out what's happening and how, what triggers what, which is obviously the work of any trauma therapist.
Right, like different parts reacted differently.
Because some parts are ambivalent and some parts are secure and some parts are avoidant. And so I think from that lens, I don't find it helpful. I don't use the attachment styles in my work personally.
I don't either.
But I get what you're saying, that understanding the terms can be really helpful, like using avoidant, using anxious, using...
Well, because it can actually name your trauma. It can help you understand how your parents traumatized you.
Yeah.
Like how their trauma became your trauma. They were avoidantly attached and then they wouldn't bond with you. That's my mother. You know, like, it's a really good way to actually name how you got hurt.
Yeah, that's really true. And that's what this training that I did, they were really adamant about that. They were like, everybody should know how the attachment styles operate and in the way that the parents are. Like, what will result if you are anxiously attached as a parent, how you can expect your dynamic with your child to be.
Yeah, and that's really in parenting. But then also, like, in partnerships and friendships, we, unless you've really healed your parts, we tend to just replay the pattern. We pick someone who plays your parents' pattern.
Yeah,
and we
you just reenact.
We also can flip it where we play our parents and we attract someone who plays the other part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can go, it's not always like exactly like a reenactment exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It is, I feel like it is a tool. It's a good tool.
Yeah, definitely.
See, now that we decided that I'm
ambivalent.
Ambivalent. Yeah. I find that helpful.
Right.
I usually call it engulfment abandonment. That's what we started with.
Mm-hmm.
I feel engulfed because I was violated. I feel abandoned because I was abandoned, you know, and I'm constantly flipping back and forth with my part. So understanding that that's how complex I am, that's helpful.
And also that that's like something that's been proven by research in attachment too, that like, this is a pattern. This is a, like, this shows up, this is the result. I think that's really cool about the attachment literature, that like they've studied it. They've done, like, there's just a wealth of research on how this shows up for people. And so it's like, if you identify with X style, you're in good company. And this is the result of something real, you know? And I know, like, we don't always need a paper to prove our experiences, but it is, like, I've read so much on attachment and like the way that caregivers treat like young children. I mean, it has like an obvious effect. And that is a fact. right? So it's not just like, oh, willy-nilly, you do whatever. And, you know, like all kids are different and all parents are different. It's like, nope, this actually is, the research shows that when we do certain things, children will, that this will result.
Right.
Which I think is really important.
Kara, I think in terms of closing, can we try to talk about healing and healing attachment trauma? Because I have this new part I'm noticing, or probably an old part that I'm now hearing, which comes in when I even acknowledge my attachment style trauma or whatever. I have this part that comes up and goes, fuck, like, I can't heal that.
You can't heal that.
Like, oh, fuck, I name my style, but like, I'm fucked. Like, now that I know that, it's proof that I'm truly fucked. That I cannot heal this because it's so fucked up. And my nervous system developed that way. And I mean, if it was my client, I would be like, no, I absolutely can heal this. This is healable. And there is proof that people heal from attachment trauma, including all my clients. Like, so many of my clients are like, oh my God, I have some clients who were like unable to have relationships and now have relationships, even friendships. I had a client who was unable to have friendships. She's a client of mine who's in her 70s. Mm-hmm. And for the very, very first time in her life, she's having friendships. First time. Never been able to. So, like, it is healable. Will you tell my part how it's healable?
I think that part, I'm curious as to why it holds that stance, you know? Like, I'm wondering why it feels so bonded to that idea.
Well, it's like, I'm so tired of getting my hopes up about healing.
So it's trying to protect that.
Yeah,
that
definitely.
Crash.
I don't want to think I can heal because that's so, makes me so vulnerable. Yeah.
And also, I think it's right that, like, what if it's saying that it's not going to go away, then it's right. That is what happened to you is part of you. And so that
You mean the trauma itself.
Right. Or also just like the style, right? If it's saying like, you can't heal this ambivalent attachment style, you're doomed. And it's like, I get what it's saying. Maybe the message is that it's saying, I don't want to have to constantly get my hopes up and then, you know, crash out after with the feelings of I thought I was healed and I'm not. And I wanted it to know that I think that that makes total sense because that is part of what happened to you. Wanting to be rid of the experience, wanting to be healed, right? Wanting to be done with the pain.
Yes.
And so I get that it's saying, I want to stop going through this roller coaster ride.
Oh my God. Why are you so intuitive? I can't believe how intuitive you are. That's exactly what I'm going through lately, that I can't make it not have happened.
Yeah.
It is so unbearable to these parts that I can't make it not have happened.
Yeah. And I think I'm intuitive because I know exactly what that means for me, like my brother dying, right? I just desperately, desperately every day ache for the ability to go back in time and make him alive. And yet I know, you know, and you've helped me with this so much. You always say to me, like, you're always going to be in pain. You're always going to wish that he was still alive. It's never going to go anywhere. And we're always going to, you know, as trauma survivors, we're always going to wish that, like, what happened to us didn't happen to us.
Yeah.
And I feel like that part is saying, don't forget, you know, that it's normal. It's normal and it's part of it to be on a roller coaster when we've experienced such terrible things.
I know.
So in a way, to expect to be healed of that feeling is wishful thinking, not realistic. And I think maybe our parts are trying to remind us of that so that we don't actually go on that roller coaster of, oh my God, I was doing so great. Oh my God, I'm in hell again. What the fuck is wrong with me? When actually that is, I think, just really what we have to face. And accept and embrace in a way.
This is so weird because this is exactly what I struggle with as a parent, is to let my daughter go through this. Let her go through pain. I let her go through pain and then she feels good and then she feels pain and then every day. And like, it's so hard to allow her to have that process because because I struggle to allow myself to have that process.
Absolutely. Yeah, totally. I've gotten a lot better. I've gotten a lot better. I feel a lot more comfortable with suffering. I feel like that's a big breakthrough with me. I was avoidant of suffering for years. I mean, I would suffer, but it would be a maladaptive, let me escape. Like, but I'd be suffering because I was escaping and I would be very depressed. Now I'm a lot more like, you know what? I'm going to feel this pain. I'm going to let this pain in. Like, I welcome it. I actually need it. And I'm not going to try to stop it from happening anymore. But I think with my daughter, that's the work. Now I've been able to do some work on myself and I'm like, I'm not there yet with my kid. So if she's bullied or if she is isolated at times, which she will be when she inevitably has conflict with peers and things and is, you know, made to feel less than or whatever, it's going to trigger that in me.
And I will help you.
Yeah.
Should we like, and like say a statement that's like an ending?
Okay, you do that. You're good at
that. Healing is possible for everyone else, but not me. But I'm so glad that you joined us today to hear about attachment, parenting, trauma, and healing for everyone else. See you next time.
Best of luck to you all. Except for Ruthia, who will never
get. Except for me. I'm so sorry.
This has been Your Kids Don't Suck. You can find me, Kara Tedstone, at www.karatedstonetherapy.com and on Instagram at Kara Tedstone Therapy. On my website, you'll find links to recommended readings and a link to my Reparenting with Mindfulness workbook, available now on Amazon.
You can find me, Ruthia Lee, at www.ruthia.com. That's RYTHEA.com. There you'll find published books, articles, and music, and parenting videos. Also, I'm on TikTok at Ruthia Lee, on Instagram at Ruthia Lee. You can book parent mentoring sessions with me through my website. And also, I have an Advice from a Loving Bitch YouTube show that helps people heal self-hatred, and that's ruthia.com/advice. It is important and essential to put our voices, Ruthia and Kara, in a context. We are two white, cisgendered, straight, middle-class women living with financial and societal privilege. Because of this, our perspectives are limited and do not reflect the realities of all of our listeners. This podcast will feature guests with expertise around conscious parenting who differ in race, class, abilities, sexual orientation, and histories from us, to broaden the conversation and reflect the lives of as many people as possible. 25% of the proceeds of this podcast will go to creators of color who have been mentors and influences on our work and in our growth as parents.
If you like our show, please subscribe and stay tuned for more conscious parenting advice and insights. And check out our link tree at linktr.ee/yourkidsdontsuck to donate and connect with us.